Welcome to the Presence and Practice podcast. I am here with some wonderful people, people of goodness, and you'll hear more about that. Laura Beringer, did I say that correctly?
Yes.
And Scott McKnight. And so you know that they are a father-daughter team. And I'll just give you a little bit about them. Laura is a kindergarten teacher. And Laura, how long have you been teaching?
Over 20 years.
Wow. Amazing. So I already said, God bless you, Laura, for teaching kindergartners and caring for their whole being and engaging them. And I'm sure they'll weave in. And then Scott is a professor of New Testament at, you're at Northern Seminary. And
a bunch of books,
and the Jesus Creed was one of the first ones that I read way back when, and written a bunch of other ones. And so, but today we're going to talk about, I'll just show it on the pivot, the practices, priorities, practices, and powers that can transform your church into a Tove culture. Well, however you guys want to start, but what inspired you to write this? What have you learned? I know since this is kind of book two, or they're kind of one unit. I don't know how you guys think of it. What inspired you and what have you been learning as you get feedback?
Go ahead, Laura.
Well, yeah. So A Church Called Tove was the first project that we worked on together. And that surprised both of us with the amount of, I don't know, a good way or bad way, but the amount of interest and feedback and conversation that people wanted to have with us. And as people read it and had time to absorb it and talk about it with their, staff or whomever, we started getting questions that became more and more frequent. Questions like, well, so you talk about a goodness culture. How do I do that? How do I transform what seems to be toxic into Tove, as you describe in A Church Called Tove? And they would ask us, what kind of red flag should I look for? What about me if I'm a lay person? What is there anything I can do? So these were pretty big questions that I personally, my dad was more equipped to answer than I was, but initially I wasn't really comfortable speaking into that. But those questions became more and more frequent as time went on. And so we attempted to answer them to the best of our ability in Pivot. We had a lot of conversations with men and women who are doing the hard work of transformation. We read research, we read case study examples, and through all of it, that was how Pivot came to be, was our attempt to answer those questions that became more frequent as time went on.
That's great. Because I think my audience will kind of be in that category. Not that they're, who knows if they're part of toxic cultures or not. Who is reading this or asking these questions? Are they pastors, elders, or position holders, or just people who care about their church who don't have that position?
Well, I think people who are, it's all across the spectrum. I mean, yeah. It can be people who are in seminaries wondering about presidents. It can be people in churches wondering about pastors. It can be people in Sunday school classes wondering about an abusive teacher, demanding, requiring homework, reprimanding people who don't do it. So it can happen. It can happen in schools. It can happen in offices. So the questions about why is someone who claims to be a believer in Jesus abusive in their behavior of others is a pervasive question. And it is a permanent question. The Apostle Paul blasts away at times with people who clearly are, he would consider them false teachers, who are abusive in their spiritual relationship. They thought they were right. So it's a pretty serious problem. And John, one of the things that we have experienced is that in a church called Tove, we put in words the experiences of other people. Hmm. So they'll read it and say, that's what I needed to hear, or that's what my church is. And I've had, I'm sure both of us have had dozens, if not hundreds of letters, decades of letters, of people who have said that very thing. I didn't realize what was going on until I read this. And now this chapter on false narratives looks like my church. Mm. What's, you know, why is my pastor like the chapter that you write about narcissism and power through fear? Why is that the case? Mm. And I was in a conversation the other night. And to me, the question starts to become, what are we doing that leads our churches and our Christian institutions to the place where narcissistic people rise to the top? What are we doing that leads to this?
Yeah.
I think we need to begin to think about that question. But no, I'm not going to write another book on that, Laura. Don't even go there.
That's what people keep asking me. Are you going to do another book? I was like, we weren't going to do Pivot.
I'm sure. Yeah, I'm sure. You know, writing a book is hard. Writing it together, different styles and approaches. How was that? That's, you know, like, what was it like to write together as two adults, but father and daughter?
Well, I'll tell you what it was like. It was like, my dad doesn't like Google Docs. He would prefer that we email a hundreds of pages manuscript back and forth. So I convinced him to use Google Docs in the early days of the manuscript. Mm-hmm. And sometimes he would leave me notes in it, like, Laura, I have to go make a phone call. Like, he would leave notes in it.
I saw that in one of the
pages. All joking set aside. So my dad would do the theology and like the layout and the outline. And then he would give me, especially for Tove, I was more self-directed, but for Pivot, he would give me reading assignments to go and find samples or whatnot.
Tove was, Laura wrote a long, 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 longer, kept growing chapter on the Willow Creek story.
My dad said, Laura, nobody wants to read all of these pages about Willow Creek. I said, yes, they do. It's a page turner. And then when the publisher got it, I think they cut it to one page.
Oh, it wasn't that long. That's exaggerated. I think it was
long. It was pretty long.
But here's the thing. I worked out the logic, the outline, the let's say the basics of the manuscript. In Tove, Laura, I would write some stuff, and then Laura would just start writing these stories into it. She would find all these things. With Pivot, it was a little different. Laura was in a difficult situation at her school. I mean, she was teaching all the time, most of this time, and she couldn't just. Yeah. Write every day. I could write every day. Mm. So I would work on the chapters and sort of give her assignments. And then like she wrote the beginning in Pivot all about the church in California with Mike Lucan and Kent Carlson. Mm-hmm. And she wrote all of that. I had read the book and then I read it again. And then Laura read it and then she wrote the story. And then there were a couple other stories that Laura wrote. And then she would find things in what she was reading and she would add them here and I would add things here. So probably in the second book, I did more of the determinative writing than in Tove, but that was mostly, I think, because of our schedules.
Sure.
The publisher wasn't as prompt in responding to an affirmative approval of our manuscript as the publisher could have been. Is that fair, Laura?
Yeah.
And how has it impacted your relationship writing these two books together? You know, and you got to interact a lot, but just, you know, I'm just curious, what's been the fruit of it?
Laura, I figured it was your turn.
Oh, I thought you might say how much you enjoyed writing with me.
We did not really struggle.
Mm. No.
In what was written in the manuscript.
We had the same thing to say. Our message was the same, which we worked well together. Like, I knew my role. You know, my dad is the theologian, the scholar, the established author. And so it was more like he would give me assignments and I would go do them. Especially with Pivot. Like I said, with Tove, I was a little bit more self-directed. Tove came more naturally. But my dad has, people have asked me, how are you such a good writer? And I've never thought of myself as a good writer. It's kind of healing and therapeutic for me to write. But my dad used to make me write essays when I was little. And I remember being very upset to be like in fourth grade on summer break writing.
That's an abuse of power. It's potential. Like, was it toxic or not? You know, like, how do we know?
It was toxic. No, I'm just kidding.
Oh, Laura loved it because she had a classroom in the attic just off her bedroom, and she saw herself as a teacher at that time, and she wrote. She can complain and bark about it now, but I think in part she really enjoyed it too, and she was proud of what she wrote. And it wasn't that often that I asked you to do that.
Well, it is a very clear memory of you making me write those essays. You wanted me to do like use my imagination to write like a novel.
Oh my God. I don't remember anything about that.
Remember Attica? Okay, well, anyways.
Oh my God, this is great. I love it.
I'm going way down a rabbit hole.
Oh, it's okay because this book flows out of the two of you. You know, and you're who you are. And, you know, you're kind of talking about the different gifts and different positions that you have. But it's kind of fun to hear those stories.
John, the other thing is we both edited one another's writing. So Laura would write something and I would edit it. And then I would write something and then she would edit it.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, I didn't need as much editing as she did.
Well, granted, given your work, but
I remember when we started writing Tove, it's the first time that I had written like that. Mm. I was like, Dad, you wrote so like you, he writes really fast.
Yeah.
Whereas for me, I'm much slower. And he said, well, I've been doing this for 50 years, you know?
Yeah.
You had more practice than I did.
That's right.
And
you learn how to write by writing.
Yes, we just had a conversation and we were coming back from a little trip and asking my friends about, you know, what question should I ask? I'm going to be on this conversation. And we were talking about ChatGPT and AI and writing and how that changes as a professor. Kindergarten, not so much, but even thinking about that. And so that's another conversation to have, but just how things are changing. You know, so I'll transition. That's a little segue, but the transition I want to make is, you know, you talk about in the book attractional versus character or spiritual formation. And if you want to define a little bit of those, but the question I have, I mean, I have a leaning. I mean, that's why I'm doing this podcast, but I can imagine people, pastor friends that I have, can't you do both? Can't you do spiritual formation?
The thing is, yes, you can, but one will probably take the upper hand and control
100%.
The ship. Yes. Character is about, let's say, the growth in virtue over time based upon personality characteristics, decisions made, moral decisions made. Character is formed over time. Attractional model churches focus on numbers. So my basic belief is I don't know any churches that genuinely focus on both.
Mm.
I know a lot of churches that say they want to get their people that come formed into Christ-likeness. But they have very weak programs for how that's going to be done. You can't do this with 5,000 people in your church.
Mm.
Not unless you have 500 pastors
mm-hmm.
who are mentoring young believers and other believers. That's an exaggeration, but not by much.
Sure.
And if you focus on character, you're probably going to have to be a slower church. You're going to be working with more people over time, and it's probably not going to explode into an extravaganza every Sunday morning.
Mm. The Sunday experience is not going to be as prominent in your attention, money, budget, time.
There, that's right.
Mm-hmm.
You're a pastor. You know what we're talking about.
I do know what those conversations around the leadership table look like and what's on the agenda, you know?
Yeah.
What would it look like? What would the agenda look like of contrasting attraction versus character or spiritual formation? Just anything that comes to your mind.
Well, I know Laura and I can both answer this question, but this one really is interesting to me. And that is, I would say, number one, who the people are reading.
Mm.
Okay. All right. So, for instance, attractional models read business literature.
Mm.
They read advertising. They read branding. The character formation models read Dallas Willard.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they read, and they also tend to read pretty important theology. I won't mention the pastor's name, but okay, I can think of many. When I have mentioned sometimes to pastors James D.G. Dunn or N.T. Wright or John Barclay or Richard Hayes, and they have no idea who I'm talking about, I know the kind of person we're talking about.
Mm-hmm.
I know the kind of church they're building. If they're not reading the most significant voices in the Bible today, they're not reading Bible stuff. They're probably reading leadership stuff and business stuff. They're the ones who tend to focus on numbers and attractional model.
Mm-hmm.
So I would say my answer to that would be, and it's only one answer, and that is they would be reading different people.
Mm. I like that. Thank you. That's a good one. Laura, what comments do you have about what would be influencing?
Mm-hmm. I just told this story at the Restore Conference this last weekend here in Chicago. I told the story of Oak Hills Church in mm-hmm. Folsom, California, and how they transformed the church from an attractional model to a spiritual formation. And the reading, like my dad just mentioned, was a big part of what led to the disturbance in their soul.
Mm-hmm.
Reading Willard and Eugene Peterson. And just the comment they made was, we realized that our church structure, our attractional model, was actually working against the invitation of Christ to experience his transformation.
Mm.
So when you say, what would an agenda look like? I don't know that they would even call it like a leadership team meeting anymore, because that kind of indicates like hierarchy.
Mm.
And I think they would be talking about what are we preaching from the pulpit? How are we going to help people? How are we going to teach them to live like Jesus lived?
Mm-hmm.
It's not about like putting on a big show, and it's not about counting how many people, but more on who are those people becoming?
Yeah.
Yeah, the pastor, instead of being a preacher and a leader and an entrepreneur, becomes a mentor, a nurturer, a true pastor.
Right, the shepherd of another human being in a relational matrix.
Yeah.
And I was asking, and my wife said, Sungshim, she said, oh, where are people learning this? You know, so the book, that's fantastic. Seminaries, Bible colleges, trainings. Is there a market for it? You know what I mean? Like, that's even business terminology. Are people drawn to it? Or is that part of the problem? So I don't want to prime it too much, but where can they learn this? If pastors are, how will they get there? Pastors, leaders, lay people.
How will they, where can they learn this?
Oh, like the stuff that's contained in the book Pivot.
Okay. Well, we like to think that we got Pivot.
Right.
The spirit has to be open to transformation, to realizing, you know, surrendering to the spirit and letting the process unfold.
Yeah.
There are untold resources for character transformation and spiritual formation in the history of the Christian church.
Mm.
But these are books, and these ideas are on different shelves than the place that many of these leaders and pastors are going to.
Mm-hmm.
And so they have to become immersed in people like Richard Foster, who wrote a book on the history of this called Streams of Living Water. I think that's what it's called.
Yeah, that sounds right.
Yeah.
And in that book, he goes through some of the great spiritual writers in the history of the church. Those have to become the people that we read. Now, John, I'm a Bible professor. I think people need to be reading the Bible. And I think this is something that's very, this has happened in my lifetime. And I don't know if my experience is out of whack with the rest of the wider church, but when I grew up and when I went to college and when I was in seminary, pastors preached through books of the Bible.
Hmm.
Bible Sunday school classes went through books of the Bible. So it was about the Bible. Somewhere along the line, pastors began preaching books by mega church pastors, and they would kind of repackage that. And home Bible studies became discussion groups about books that people were reading.
Mm-hmm.
And over the years, the Bible was more and more available and less read.
Mm-hmm.
So I do believe that it's a revolutionary transformation to ask churches to move in the direction of Christ-likeness, Christoformity, versus attractional model of seeing how many people we can get to church on Sunday.
Yeah. I think one of the things that you talk about in your book is emulation, not information. You probably say it better than that, but basically, and that's what my wife and I teach. I mean, we're both therapists. It's you become like the people you're drawn to. You know, your right brain becomes like their right brain in another way. And I love that you both give examples of that. Laura, you talk about Mr. Rogers and almost like studying him to help you prepare to be a good teacher. And can both of you comment on that? But starting with you, Laura, like, why Mr. Rogers, and what did you learn about emulation versus information?
So first, why Mr. Rogers? Because this is my dad's, I think I'm quoting you, Dad, because he's dead and we know that he was Tove.
Okay.
So we can't pick a living person because there's too many scandals and problems.
Mm.
And when you think of Mr. Rogers, there's nobody better at seeing children and meeting them where they are than Mr. Rogers. And we had read from multiple sources that what you saw on TV was the actual man.
Mm-hmm.
He was who he was.
Yeah.
His persona was who he was.
Mm-hmm.
And so whenever I watch Mr. Rogers as an adult, I've read his autobiography. I've seen the movie, that beautiful movie about him a couple years ago. I never thought of myself being a kindergarten teacher. I taught first grade, second graders, never thought in my lifetime I would teach kindergarten. But when I teach it, I'm so much more in awe of Mr. Rogers as a kindergarten teacher than I ever have been as a first or second primary grade, because just how I'm so inspired by him to see children and hear children. And when they say to value their feelings and like he would say one time, like he would just get down on their level. And if one of them said like, my fish died, that would derail him for a half hour. He would be like, your pets are important. That was a part of your family. How are you feel? And I just, every time I see him, I'm like, that's the kind of teacher I want to be. I want to connect with my students the way he connected, but he did it on a level to let them know how important they are.
Wow. So it was the relationship that in that inspired you about Mr. Rogers.
Yeah.
The statement, John, is education is more about emulation than information. And so what Laura, this was a very interesting process because it was a growing experience for both of us. In writing Tove, the first book, we were finding examples, and Laura would find these really cool examples, and I'd say, I know that guy, that's not going to work. This is not the sort of person we want to be.
And in fact, we had to take names out in the next printing of Tove because that's what happened. Yeah.
So I sort of formed a principle later in the process. It wasn't at the beginning. And I said, the examples that we're going to tell are going to be about dead people because their virtues have been assessed and evaluated, and we know what they're really like over time. But I do believe that we need to raise up in our churches models worthy of emulation. We need to talk about the kind of people that we should be like.
Yes, yes.
Rather than the people who are famous, you know? I know everybody's all gaga right now about, what's her name? Swifties. Taylor Swift. Okay, because she goes to football games because she's dating
Travis Kelce.
Okay, so we have this sort of thing. This is what dominates the news, the newscasts, and you know, that doesn't matter one bit. But people want to be like her because she has sold an image, and I don't know a thing about her music. I wouldn't recognize a song. If it was played, if that was her, I wouldn't know what it was like. Although,
what about the show Friends? Have you heard of that?
I have heard of the show Friends. I knew about the show.
No, you didn't.
I knew about the show.
No, you
didn't.
I never
watched it, but I did not know about the pivot story.
I
think it's really important to begin to use stories about people who are worthy of emulation.
I think that's beautiful and it's simple, but how can people do that? Like, let's say they're whatever position they hold at church, they faithful goer or participant, leader, pastor, how do they do that? You know, I mean, I don't think it's a complicated answer, but I just want to hear you.
Too. Well, I think number one, we need to find historic examples.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So there's some major people in the history of the church. Some of them are just real pain in the backsides, you know, but they were very successful. Like Martin Luther. I think Martin Luther is a bit of a nut myself. I'm not talking about Martin Luther King. I'm talking about Martin Luther, Lutheran.
Yeah.
But we need to find examples of people like St. Macrina in the Eastern Church and Gregory of Nyssa, as opposed to St. John Chrysostom, who was an abuser of power, although his influence was great. And we need, and so let's just say in the history of the church, we pick people. In the history of the United States, we pick people. You know, I think Abraham Lincoln was a pretty good guy, right? And it's not bad to use people like him. I also think we need to find people in our church that we can tell stories about, of the good that they have done.
What does
so
that look
it's
like?
It's not like John Calvin and Augustine. It's Lori Nelson, who's in your local church.
Mm-hmm.
that you say, oh, there's a Tove person.
Yeah.
So I think, yeah. Now, it's easy for the pastor, the preachers, because they, and the teachers, because they could say this, but it needs to be done in other ways where people begin to say, this is a person that we need to follow. This person has wisdom. This person has maturity. This person exudes love. This person fights for justice, those sorts of things.
Yeah. Laura, do you have comments on that? How to do that? How to hold up goodness that we see in people?
Well, I was hoping my dad would, are you saying at a Sunday service, Dad?
Churches, yeah. I mean, if it's a preacher, it's probably going to be Sunday. Yeah. But in a church community, mm-hmm. you can find people that you meet with. You want to be like. That's one of the central questions. Who do you want to be like?
Because I'm thinking of like mentoring relationships. Yeah. Mr. Rogers came to mind again as you were asking the question. Is his producers? Somebody on his show, I'm pretty sure it was one of his producers. And she said, I was just one of hundreds of employees at the Fred Rogers company. Her husband died. Yeah. The doorbell rings and it's Fred Rogers. And she was like, he just wanted to be with me when my husband passed. And, you know, those are the kind of people that those kind of stories should be told. He never did that for attention. Nobody knew that story until his death, after his death.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I think it's stories like that, you know, find somebody that is worthy of emulation. That person probably doesn't want to be on stage or have their story told, but you know,
good point.
Yeah.
And then, yeah, you're saying personally, can we ask ourselves, who do I want to be like that's in this community? You know, like,
yeah.
How can we, and then another thing I'm just thinking about as I hear you two share, can we verbalize that to them? You know, like, I really admire this about you. You know, like, can that be embedded part of our culture? Small groups, you know?
Yeah, I think that in a local church community, that is a really good thing to do, to express affirmations like that. I have a professional relationship with my students. I'm their teacher.
Uh-huh.
I'm not their therapist. And I think that it's a professional grievance to, let's say, swallow up your students into some kind of therapeutic relationship. It's unprofessional for a therapist to have a friendship and to, you know, to cross relationships like this. And as a professor, I'm not really their mentor, except as, let's say, in my field.
Uh-huh.
So over the years, I've had students who just sort of, I could tell they wanted to have a mentoring relationship with me. And I think, you know, I'm your professor. I'm not your pastor. I'm not your mentor. Uh-huh. I can mentor you as an academic if you want to go in that direction. And I can help you in your pastoral teachings. But I'm not I can't have a mentoring relationship with 95 students at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
It's unprofessional.
Mm-hmm. And unfeasible.
Yeah.
Yes. Well, you talk about the importance of conversations and how that's like the nitty gritty, minute details of how transformation happens. You know, we got to hold up the virtue, the character that's important. And then having good conversations and even having a lot of them. And is that tiresome? And how do you do it? And how do you keep it fresh?
What we're going for there is Pivot is written to help people transform their cultures. And the assumption is that those who are reading it, hopefully and prayerfully, are wanting to put as much goodness into the soil as possible and remove what is toxic. So the purpose of conversations, and we also included our new Tove tool comes with the book Pivot, The purpose of that is to get groups talking so that the healthy parts of a culture are uncovered and so are the unhealthy parts. And the TOV tool is designed as a conversation piece. It's not like statistically normed by psychologists. It's written by a theologian and organized by the theologian's daughter into categories of TOV, of what would make your culture one of goodness. And so the purpose of the conversation chapter is kind of leading towards that, is kind of leading towards having those authentic transformational conversations that will lead to goodness, that will lead to removing what is toxic. And yes, the answer is it's going to take a long time. Our understanding is that transforming a culture takes 7 years at least. So it's not an easy, quick process. I know some churches are planning to use the whole TOV tool at one time. Others are going to take it like one topic a month. We're going to have conversations about putting people first. And that's going to be our focus. So it's meant to be slow and purposeful. And people are going to have to be courageous and trusting and to tell the truth about the good things and the negative things that they've experienced in the organization.
And have you, so people of any level of influence, the small group leader, the lay person who cares about the church, they, any comments on what would be a good, or give them hope? It's possible, even if you don't hold a senior position or even like you're just a core member. Can you give some like hope and wisdom on that for the people who are listening?
You know, this is one of the most common questions we were asked at the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
And I was talking to a group of pastors one day, and one of the pastors said this in the class. He said, if someone in the church is, let's just say, I don't think he used the word marginal, but let's just say an attender. They don't teach a class. Not very many people know them. And they have a complaint about the church, and they want to get something changed. He said, I would just recommend that they leave. Because if they're not going to be happy till things change, they're not in a position to make this happen. It was very realistic, and I thought, whoa, you know, I'd rather approach this from a different angle, but it was wise at the same time. The thing is, I believe that change like this occurs organically. It doesn't happen systemically. Mm-hmm. You don't make a top-down decision and say, now we're going to be TOV, or we're not going to have any fear culture in our church. Or we're not going to have, we're going to be a church that puts people first. That doesn't happen because of a series of sermons. Even a 12-week series of sermons is not going to do this. It will begin to influence. So in a sense, we began with the smallest group in mind, and we call this a pocket of TOV.
Yeah.
And that is you start working on being TOV yourself, and you find a couple people that you trust and you know and you're safe with who are making that kind of commitment to be TOV, and just see where it takes you.
And then hope
that it can grow into other groups. Go ahead, Laura.
I met somebody this weekend who was excited to tell me that she had formed a pocket of TOV and that a baby in their group is named TOV.
No way.
Somebody named their baby TOV.
Wow.
Is that right?
Yes. I'll send you a picture of baby TOV. Yeah.
Baby TOV. Well, I got another letter this week from someone who found, I think it was in a mall. There was a store called TOV. T-O-V.
She was excited. I said, she named him TOV like because of a church called, oh yeah, yeah. That's where they got the name TOV. And they're in our pocket of TOV and the baby's name is TOV.
Wow. That's cool.
That's good.
Something new, you know, and literally, and that's I really like that. Just start, of course, starts with yourself and gather a few people. What's the dynamic with that group and then senior leadership? I know you talk about it in the book, because I'm sure that group, you don't want it to be just merely a pain in the butt for the leadership. You want it to be effective pain in the butt, if that's helpful.
Yeah, this is a big issue, John, because many times it's going to be the pastor who wants the church to be Tov. And if the pastor's Tov, the church probably is already moving in that direction, and he may not know it or she may not know it.
Mm-hmm.
But sometimes the pastor wants to see it move to Tov, and the pastor needs as much change as other people. So I just want to emphasize, it can't be top down. But if you as a church make a commitment that you want the church to become Tov, and you know there are significant areas that need improvement, then I believe what we say in the book is we believe in forming a transformation agent. I don't think it should be the senior pastor. It needs to be somebody else. Now, this is difficult, and this is a professor saying that, because that means the pastor is going to have to surrender some power. But then you have to start working one step at a time with the Tov tool and other kinds of evaluation techniques to find out where you need to start working. And you have to work one thing at a time. And to become Tov needs to be marked out by what a Tov person looks like, what a Tov small group looks like, what a Tov church looks like, and then start moving in that direction and figure out the virtues, the moral qualities, the practices, the inner character that has to be like in order to lead into those goals. And it's a big time commitment. And this is, we learned in the business world, when it is more top down, that when everybody is on board for a transformation of a business, it takes 7 years.
Wow.
So it's a long term process, because the church is in the condition that it's in because of its history, the culture that was formed over time. It takes a long time to form the culture that we find in our churches. It's going to take twice that long to form a different culture, because you have to resist the old culture.
Mm-hmm.
Old habits die slowly.
Yes, they do. Die to yourself. Just in the way of Christ, something has to die and something has to come alive. You have to name those things. That's what you're saying. And put practices around them.
Yeah.
And I like your start small, start with yourself, start with your small group and build on that.
Yep.
And name your babies Tov. I'm just kidding.
That's hilarious. That is really
funny.
That's
and he's so cute. He's so cute.
Thank God.
I got a picture of baby Tove.
Okay. So one question, what about the cultural dynamics, in terms of is this for white evangelicals? I mean, I know the answer that toxic and Tove cultures can exist and all, but it's written from, you both look like two white people. So how does it translate? What are you seeing or hearing? Or is that's primary audience? Kind of hearing, just get your input on kind of different cultures and how it's working itself out.
Okay, this is a difficult one, and there's a couple answers. There are some fundamental principles here that transcend cultures, and I think emulation, character formation, be an example, go slowly. I think all those things are true for all cultures. But the one thing that I would say is, this is, I as a white man and Laura as a white woman, I'm not going to tell African Americans how to change their churches, or Latin Americans or Asian Americans. So in a sense, it is reflective of ourselves and our culture, with the hope that this could help people in other cultures work toward Tov. But I remember someone asking me, and actually offering a criticism, which is not exactly what Twitter does. It usually denounces about the lack of African-American emphasis in the first book. And I thought, the last thing I'm going to do is start telling bad stories about African-American churches.
Right.
We had, we also had, remember at the Topher Women event at Northern, we had some African or some Asian-American women tell us about the problems in their church. And they said, you know, there aren't cultural examples in Tove. And we felt the same way about that, is like, we're not in any place to be criticizing an Asian American church. Mm-hmm. So yeah, that it is reflective of our culture. And like my dad said, hopefully we have a lot of problems in our culture, right? The white evangelical church. So hopefully some of what we wrote about can transcend culture.
And I don't believe in homogenizing. Yeah. You know, Asian Americans are like this and African Americans are like this, but we're all really alike. Well, that is not going to work for me. I don't believe that. Mm-hmm. But I think some of these principles, you know, the major ideas are transcultural at some level. Mm-hmm. But I think an African American church in the city of Chicago would look at cultural transformation in a different way than a white church in the suburbs.
Yes. So. No, great. That's great to hear. And yeah. So we're, in a sense, maybe potentially modeling how we're taking care of this white ethnic, you know, aspect of how we're going to bring Tove into our cultures. Mm-hmm. And then it's not like, although churches are primarily one ethnic group, probably across the world and certainly in the U.S., but there are some churches that have some diversity, and that probably is more complex. Well, one, maybe this is kind of the last question I'll have, is because I think you do talk about one church that says they're going to work on one thing, and the one thing they're going to change was they're going to the fuller sense of what the gospel is. And because that shapes what we're seeking after, what we want to emulate. And so both of you can comment, but maybe this is a little more geared towards Scott. What can you share that story and kind of, yeah. I want to end with the gospel, you know, like, yeah. Bring us the good news, Scott.
Well,
a good place to end.
This was an interesting story because the church wanted to move from, let's say, a gospel. You come to the church in an attractional model and get saved and go to heaven when you die because Jesus came to die for your sins. They wanted to move to what they called a kingdom gospel. Now, the kingdom gospel for this church is a little different than what I understand of kingdom in my book, Kingdom Conspiracy. But their idea was more, we want to become outward focused and justice focused. Mm-hmm. We want to start building this into the DNA of our church. And they worked on this inside the circle of leaders, beginning with a couple small group, just a couple people. Then it grew a little bit bigger, and eventually it moved to like 200 people, the inner core of the church. For 5 years, they worked on this idea and began practicing it. Even the pastor said that he had to work in a homeless kitchen for a year without telling anybody. For the simple reason that he didn't think he could ask people to do things that he hadn't done himself, which I thought, that's a good thing. All right, mm-hmm. So then they worked on justice. Before they went public with the church, they worked on this behind the scenes, in a sense, with the leaders for 5 years. That's the kind of transformation that is so important now. A kingdom, let's say, as they defined it, a kingdom focused church versus, let's say, a salvation focused church. Mm-hmm. This is the way they were talking. Is not the same as character formation, but it will lead towards some character changes. Mm-hmm. So it's not quite the same, but it was a major transformative element in the church, mm-hmm. and it took a long time. Mm. It's a good example of how long it takes.
Wow. Well, what words of blessing would you have for the people who hear this conversation between the three of us? Laura and Scott.
Laura can finish for us.
Yeah.
I would say thank you for listening. We know transformation is possible. We can work together towards it. We know it's possible because we've seen it happen, because we've heard and read beautiful stories of transformation in the last 3 years. So the work is hard, but it's worth it. And it's always worth it to surrender to the Spirit and follow His promptings where He leads. And sometimes that's where the deepest transformation comes from, those disturbances.
Hmm. Amen.
I say amen. I say amen.
And thank you so much. Really appreciate
it. Thank you.
Thank you, John.
Nice to meet you. Thanks for having us on.
Yes.